exciting episode of There Can Only Be One. I'm joined with my original co-host, Liam Coughlin.
Hello.
He's back.
I am back. I'm alive.
The prodigal son returns.
I do.
All right, so in this episode, we're going to be talking about tuning a deck, sticking with a deck for more than 1 week. Both of our strong suits. All right. Maybe not our strong suits, but it's something we both want to work on.
Yeah, it's something that we both do in other formats that aren't Highlander.
Yeah, certainly.
But we don't do it in Highlander.
And it's something I think we both want to work on in Highlander, because it's typically how you sort of, like, flesh out an archetype, and you often learn a lot about cards that other people don't play very often, because it allows you to sort of play with and experience cards in a way that other people may not have done before.
Yeah, and for me specifically, right, like, as some of you will know, I was living in Halifax for the last year and a half, which is why I disappeared from much of the sort of audio-based media here. When I was in Halifax, I didn't play that much Magic. So coming back, I played a couple of different decks the first couple of tournaments here back in Victoria, and I, like, played pretty poorly, and part of that was to do with the fact that I just, like, wasn't super comfortable with, like, playing Magic that much, so I decided to sort of play one deck and play it for a couple of weeks in hopes of picking it back up a little bit in terms of the playing tight. So that's, like, another reason to do it, too. It really helps you. You can play better playing a deck you know how to... You've played a bunch of times than a deck you're, like, maybe more unfamiliar with, because it's easier to sort of envision where the lines of play are going
to
go.
Exactly. It's especially good for newer people to the format to pick up and play one deck
as opposed to
playing a bunch of different decks. And it also can be really interesting in terms of, like, developing a deck and seeing where you can take it as well, because, like, lots of decks sort of have many different versions, and especially given the meta, can look very different. Like, there's a lot, like, recently I'd say the biggest example has been the white weenie deck, like Adam Thorne's, like, sort of more colorless focused, bigger, cutting all the one drops version looks very different to Rowan's, like, very low to the ground, high disruption, high hate bear count.
Almost no four drops, like, just trying to kill you as quickly as possible.
And both have had, like, pretty reasonable success with the deck.
Mm-hmm.
Spencer as well. He was actually sort of, like, in the middle of the two,
I'd say. Well, and recently Spencer's been playing blue in his deck.
Yeah, also there's the different splashes you can experiment with as well. So it's really interesting, I think, to sort of see the different takes people have on the deck and how tuning a deck can sort of impact where you end up.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of those choices that we just talked about, right, deciding to go low or go high or to splash another color, are choices that you can make when you first build the deck, but they're choices that you make with better justification when you're tuning the deck, right?
Exactly. And tuning a deck is sort of like a branch, like branches, right? You can like always backtrack and explore a different branch later on. Like,
yeah, absolutely. For sure. But,
yeah.
Yeah, if you discover the blue splash is heinous or whatever, you don't like it, I mean, you can take it out of your deck. It's not that hard.
Yeah.
Or if
you try a black splash or a green splash or a red splash, even.
Or a colorless splash now.
Yeah, exactly.
That one's hot. I like that one.
More hot splashes available.
Yeah. but that's the basic idea of, like, why you might want to tune a deck or what the values are to tuning a deck. I mean, obviously, there's more value to that than that as well, right? Like, I know not everyone's sort of preferred thing to do in Magic is even deck building, right? Like, a lot of people get a lot of fulfillment out of taking an already existing archetype and tuning it, right? You, like, start with a list that maybe someone else made, you play that list once, you say, I didn't like this card, and, you know, you eventually maybe only add 10 or 15 cards or something, but you end up with a very different looking deck that you sort of feel like you've had a significant impact on creating. And some people get more fulfillment from doing that than they do from...
Yeah, I know a couple of the newer players to the scene really like that aspect. Kevin Boston in particular, who's had some success, really enjoys that part, as opposed to necessarily coming up with his own deck. Just, mm-hmm. like, taking a list and then sort of tweaking it to fit his personal play style. And he's had, as I say, some amount of success doing that.
Yeah, he's, like, won a couple tournaments, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Which is, like, pretty good for somebody relatively new to the scene.
Yeah, for sure. So today we're going to talk about what the process of tuning a deck actually is. We'll talk you through that. And then we'll sort of highlight the important things about tuning a deck and things you might discover along the way. And then we'll go do some case studies, firstly of the deck that I've been playing for the last couple of weeks. And then we're going to talk about the deck that Jeremy is playing just starting today at this Highlander tournament and has sworn to play for at least one more tournament after this one, which is, I mean, it's not the first time it's happened ever, but does not happen often. So
yeah, this is a big ask of me to play, play a deck multiple times
more,
in a row.
Than once.
Very, very foreign to me.
Right. So when you're, when you're tuning a deck, obviously it's important to know the distinction between building and tuning.
Yeah.
And so...
So we had our episode on building a deck.
Yeah.
And you often, like, end up with a huge pile of cards.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the way we did it is you build it on Cockatrice, then you go to the kitchen table where your boxes of magic cards are. Then you end up with more cards than you need because you're like, oh man, I didn't put Edric in my banned creature deck.
Yeah, I really want to play that card.
Classic blunder. So then you end up coming back with, say, 80 to 90 spells, and you need to cut a bunch of them and figure out which cards to cut, which cards to end up keeping in the deck. So you end up with this sort of like maybe board, which ends up being like 15 to 25 cards.
Or in my case, 40. But yes.
Yeah. and so these are often the cards you end up using in the process of tuning. After you play your first tournament, you come back and you see this card, a pile of 15 to 25 cards on your mm-hmm. table, and you're like, man, this one card was hot garbage in my deck tonight.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, and then you like see a card you really wanted to play on top of your maybe board stack, and you're like, yeah, get in.
Yeah, yeah, that's what shows up. And so there's sort of a fairly simple way to think about tuning a deck. The first is to like build a deck. We've had other podcasts about that. There's a lot of sort of discussion about what you should do in order to go about building a deck. And even for purposes of this, you could literally take someone's list that they posted online and copy it card for card. That would be fine. You could even do that.
Good starting point.
Yeah.
Good starting point.
What you then have to do is you have to play the tournament. Or, you don't even necessarily have to play a tournament, but to play a bunch of games.
Jam some matches.
Right. Yeah. Get some experience. Then you want to ask yourself four sort of different questions.
I'm just going to interrupt one thing. It's important to not just play against one deck when you're playing. You want to play against a variety of decks because you just don't want your results to be biased against the one deck you just played against.
Yeah. It's like
same as if you play in a tournament and you play against mono red three times, maybe play another tournament.
Yeah.
Like maybe your deck just has a bad mono red matchup. Lots of decks do. It's not necessarily a bad thing. You're not always going to play mono red three times a night.
Right. You might look at the Aven Mind Sensor in your deck and think this card's terrible, but it turns out when you play against non-monocolor decks, it might be better. You should wait until you get to play those matchups as well before evaluating it.
Don't cut Aven Mind Sensor.
That card's good. but yeah, so there are four questions you should ask yourself. When you finish playing the matches you play, you know, sort of a number where you've played against a reasonable spread of matchups and players, the four things you want to look at are which cards overperformed, so what cards were like really good and maybe even exceeded expectations. You want to look at what cards underperformed, so were sort of below expectations or were just horrendous in some instances. You want to think about what cards you wish you had drawn, so maybe you were like in this top deck situation, you're looking at the board state, you're thinking, man, it'd be really good if I drew X spell. You want to think about what those cards were, and you want to think about the opposite as well. You want to think about what cards you were thinking, oh my god, it would be horrendous if I drew this card right now, I could never win the game.
Yeah, or what cards you continually drew and were like, ugh. If you were anything else.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess that goes back to underperformed a bit.
Well, but it fits into this category as well. So you want to look for those four different types of cards. Once you find those cards, that's when you can really start the actual tuning process. And so typically what I would do is after every tournament, I would sort of mentally go through my head, ask these questions, and I'd find not very many usually. You know, it'd usually be like three or four cards, sometimes five, that I thought, man, this card was bad. I don't want it in my deck anymore. And the cards that you like, you don't actually have to like necessarily do anything with them in particular, but you should make a note. Just in case you maybe play another tournament where they're bad, you know, you play a matchup spread where they're not as useful. You want to be able to remember, well, okay, they weren't great in this matchup, but in this other tournament I played where I played a different spread of decks, I thought they were really good, so I probably shouldn't lose faith just yet.
And also for, say, when your next deck project, you can sort of come back and be like, oh, these cards were great in this deck. Maybe slot them in, because they may also just be great cards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's absolutely true, too. And so once you do that, as Jeremy said, you often, when you build a deck, actually end up having just, like, 25 to 40 to, the worst I've ever had is 70 cards left over. I did, in fact, set aside 130 cards and need to cut 39 or 59 of them. That was good. Yeah, I had lands in that stack as well. It was fine. but yeah, so you'll come back and you'll see these cards, and you might just pick these cards from this pile of cards because it's obviously cards you wanted to have in your deck anyway. You might also find that your deck is missing a specific niche, right? You might think, you know, and this is a rare thing to think, I grant, but you might think, you know, my deck really needs a life gain spell. Or maybe more broadly, in a more intelligent way to think about it, is, man, my deck really struggled against the aggressive strategies. And so you might want to then, even if you didn't have these cards in your stack initially, look through your collection, maybe look on Gatherer for a card that might fit that role that you felt like your deck was lacking. So that's sort of the basic process. You find the cards that were good, make sure you take a note of that. Find the cards that are bad, take them out of your deck, and then go somewhere to replace them. Oftentimes you're going to have an idea of what you want to put in anyway, because, you know, maybe you didn't play Loxodon Smiter in your Abzan aggro deck because you thought it was just a vanilla 4-4, and then you played against Control and, like, a couple of mid-range discard decks, and you thought, nah, this 4-4 is actually very good, and I would like to have it in my deck, right? Like, you...
It's a 4-4 that's just always going to be in play.
Yeah, exactly.
That guy's real good. Real good at getting in play.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's a choice you could make, right? And you might find that in that same kind of, like, Abzan aggro deck, you might have thought Grimflare was going to be great, and it turns out your deck is, like, actually mostly creatures and lands. Turning on Delirium is way harder than you thought it was. It died a bunch of the time. And I don't actually know if Grimflare is a bad card in that style of deck or not, but, you know, hypothetically, you might discover this.
Yeah.
And so maybe you'd make that swap. You'd be like, Grimflare, sit on the bench for a tournament. We're gonna bring Loxodon Spider in, and you can evaluate from there.
Another really good resource I've seen players use recently is after the tournament, or even in between rounds, is to lay their deck out and ask one of the more experienced players to go over it and say, like, hey, you think I'm missing any cards? I've been thinking about these cards. What do you think about those? And they just make a list.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, like, writing down all the cards that people say. And then they at least have a list of things, like, they can maybe add to their maybe board.
Yeah.
They can think about them some more, maybe kibosh some of them and, like, star some others for ones they think might be really good. But that's another valuable suggestion, especially if you don't have, like, all the cards in the world and sitting on your kitchen
table.
Right,
in front of you. Or if you're not as an experienced Magic player, right? Like, you might just not have a sort of, like, wealth of knowledge in your head of exactly the kind of cards you need to fill this niche role. And there are certainly people who do, right? There are people who have spent a lot of time playing this game, have played a bunch of different decks, are aware of a larger volume of cards, and you can certainly ask them. And it's important not to be afraid to ask people what they think, too, I think. It's
very true.
Especially when you're tuning a deck, it's like, you can kind of set aside the pride of trying to be the first one to build this particular archetype, right? And you can just worry about making this deck as good as it can be.
Yeah.
And, you know, if other people help you with that, you end up with a better deck out of the deal. So it's probably worth it.
I actually think that attitude towards, like, entering the format especially often lands you in a better spot than if you try to, like, focus on building your own deck. Obviously, different people come at it, and as you said earlier, gain
fulfillment from different things.
But if your, like, overarching goal is to, like, being successful at these Highlander tournaments, starting off with a solid base is probably going to land you in better stead.
Yeah, I agree. So the next thing we want to talk about is that when you're making these card decisions, either about cards to put in or cards to take out, it's really important to try cards. It's so easy to look at, especially new cards, but just cards you haven't played before in general, and say, oh, I think this card's unplayable. Doesn't look any good. All these other people say it's unplayable. Yeah, all right, I won't try this one. And I think that Jeremy was talking about this as well, but that this is an attitude that gets pretty pervasive around lesser played or not played cards. And you should not be afraid to try things, but it's important to do so with sort of like a modicum of moderation, right? You want to make sure that you're not putting 5 experimental cards in your deck or 10 experimental cards in your deck at a time, because you might not actually, you might dilute your deck so much by doing that that you're no longer effectively evaluating how good those cards are in concert with the rest of your deck. You're now evaluating how good they are with each other. And inevitably, when you're playing underplayed cards, I mean, some of them actually are bad. That just does happen some of the time.
Yeah.
So it's important to try them out kind of one or two at a time. And we've set aside, we've got some examples of cards that either seem bad or people have said are bad, that we are playing in the decks we're going to talk about today or have been played before in the format or are now sort of like reasonable staples.
Or cards we have vowed to play much more of because we've tested them and we think they're very good, and not necessarily in that one deck, but in other decks potentially or very likely.
Yeah, exactly. So some of these cards are Gonti. What's his actual epithet?
He's like Lord of Luxury.
Gonti, Lord of Luxury.
I started playing this deck a month ago when I went on a sort of a tear of playing a bunch of different black-based mid-range decks. And Gonti actually was one of the latest inclusions in my first iteration,
right,
which was, I think, was like black-white. I played black-green first. And I put Gonti in because I was playing Survival and Recurring Nightmare, and I just wanted more like value creatures with ETB abilities.
Right, yeah, you just want your creatures to actually function.
And Gonti won me several games.
Yeah.
And I was like very curious, so I put him straight in the overperformed category.
Right.
And then I played Black-White the next week, which was like less based on just like value creatures, and it was more of like a classic, just like mid-range good stuff,
kill
all your things, rip apart your hand.
Right.
Have a thing. And Gonti also
very good in that
good in that deck. And then I played Mono Black.
Yeah,
Gonti also very good in that deck.
Seems very good in that one.
I've decided that this card is just very good and underplayed.
Yeah, well, and I mean, in the finals 2 weeks ago, or in the semifinals, I guess, there was a playoff 2 weeks ago. There was a pretty sweet line where Mike Simpson cast Gonti against a Blue Moon player who let it resolve, and then he got to cast Ancestral Recall with his last black mana remaining.
That's pretty exciting.
Yes, he did, in fact, win that game. And I guess it's important when you're evaluating cards like this to not just look at the spikes like that. Like, obviously that's insane, but to look at, like, the worst case for the card as well. And I played Gonti just this week. I switched decks to an Abzan Pod deck, and I played him in that. And, or Aetherborn are genderless, aren't they?
I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah. I played Gonti in that deck. Basically, like, cast it, and it did nothing, right? Like, I didn't hit any valuable spell, but then it, like, traded for a 6-5 because it has Death Touch, right? Like,
that's the thing to look at with this card, is, like, the body is relevant because it will always trade with any ground creature.
Mm-hmm.
And the third toughness is relevant because it'll just eat a bunch of other creatures, so it makes attacks much worse.
Yeah.
And it impulses your opponent's deck.
Yeah.
And, like, Impulse is a valuable card that I'm sure almost every blue deck plays, and I'm sure if you could ask non-blue decks if they would play Impulse in their deck, virtually all of them would say yes.
Yeah, well, especially when it comes stapled to a creature, right? Like,
exactly. And I think people look at it and like, oh, I don't care about what's in my opponent's deck. Why would I want that effect? And it's like, turns out your opponents also probably play good cards.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
If your opponent's playing bad cards, that's probably good for you anyways.
Well, there's also the hidden value, too, if you just get to take a card out of their deck, right? Like, so, if you're playing against a combo deck and you just Gonti their Tendrils,
the game is over, they
cannot win.
You just take it and never cast it.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it's exiled face down and they don't know where it is.
Yeah.
They'll figure it out eventually.
They will. So Gonti, good card. Another one that Jared knows way more about, I didn't play when this set came out, is Throne of the High City. And for anyone who doesn't know what this card does, is it a legendary land? It doesn't really matter for Islanders. But it's a land that produces colorless mana, and then for 4 and sacrificing it, you can become the monarch.
Yeah, and I think this is actually maybe the most underplayed card in Highlander at the moment. People have been experimenting a lot with the monarch mechanic recently, and have discovered that even supremely average cards become playable when they have that text stapled to them.
Yeah. Palace Jailer in particular, right? It's like,
Palace Jailer is reasonable. People have been playing the 4-mana 2/4 that says you become the monarch.
Oh, wow. And I know I've seen people playing the, it's like the 5-mana, your opponent sacrifices a creature, you become the monarch.
It sacrifices a creature whenever you become the monarch.
And you become the monarch as well.
And you become the monarch.
Yeah.
Which is relevant. I've played that card as well. That card
seems hot.
Yeah. Pretty. I was... I was less impressed with it than Gaunti, but it had a couple nice appearances, and those Custody Lich is that one.
Yeah.
So the reason this card is very good is because the downside on it is very low. Like, if your deck can afford to play a colorless land, like, its floor is, it's just going to be a colorless land. If you don't want to introduce the Monarchy this game, you don't have to.
Yeah.
Which is sort of the problem with, I think, these other cards, is, like, sometimes you draw this card, this creature, and it's like, you need to cast something, but you don't want to introduce the Monarchy into this game. It's likely not going to be good for you.
Right,
like,
you're
way
gonna
behind
draw
on board.
Yeah,
you're going to draw one card,
and then they're going to draw, like, 10.
Exactly, and it's just setting them up to, like, sort of snowball over you. Whereas, if you draw this card, and you don't want to introduce it, don't do it. But I think it's great in control, great in one and two color midrange decks, even great as, like, a utility land in aggro decks that are, like, potentially playing the Eldrazi package.
Right.
Like, and it's a great way to, like, sort of flood prevention.
I mean, the big thing about it is that it's basically a free roll a lot of the time. Like, it is a colorless land, but usually that's fine. It's not the end of the world. And actually, I just wanted to come back to the thing you talked about with control decks. I think the thing about this card in control decks that's especially insane is that, like, oftentimes control decks can get kind of barbecued by, like, Palace Jailer in particular. You, like, play your Consecrated Sphinx, they Palace Jailer it, and now they're the Monarch, and you've played one of the three creatures in your deck, right? Like, you just have such a hard time taking Monarch away from those aggro decks as a control deck, and the way you kind of have to construe your play in order to do so also just, like, really opens you up. But if you just have this land in play, then, like, sure, you can Palace Jailer my Consecrated Sphinx, I will take it back at my next earliest convenience, which will be, like, probably in a turn or two, right? Like, and it'll be fine.
And it creates a situation where they can't attack you.
Right.
Because you can just instant speed get your Sphinx back.
Right. Well, and what makes it even better is that if you do ever get it back, I mean, sure, the aggro deck with a one-sided Howling Mind is pretty good. The control deck with a one-sided Howling Mind is, like, even better. So that card is, like, probably underplayed, but that's one that, like, doesn't really have much evidence for it yet. The card that I think is most interesting to talk about is that when I lived in Victoria last, so, like, 2 years ago at the most, everyone said you can't play Scapeshift, that this card isn't playable. The combo is too janky, you have to put too many mountains in your deck, it doesn't work, you shouldn't try and play it. And I even did try and play it once. I played, like, a Naya land destruction deck or something. And since I was incidentally ramping so much, I put Scapeshift in my deck. And I think I cast it once, and I won the game or something. But, like, I did not cast it very much. But then, after I left, Jeremy sort of said, I'm not sure this card's bad.
Well, the best way to get me to test something is to tell me it's bad and unplayable.
Right.
And I'm, like, thinking about it, and I'm like, no, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd make it playable.
Right, yeah, exactly. And so there is now, like, Rogue Scapeshift is just an archetype, right? Like, we don't have to tell you that Scapeshift is a good card. Like, if you have played Modern, you're aware that it's very powerful, and just conceptually the card is very powerful, and really what it was is that no one was willing to put in the time in order to find a way to build a list that was going to work, and the problem was is that people were trying to build these ramp decks. They were going kind of all in on ramping as quickly as possible and trying to tutor for Scapeshift as quickly as possible. And though that strategy is okay, it's inconsistent. But it turns out that if you just play a rug deck that's just kind of this, like, mid-range control deck that has this I win button, it's, like, totally fine to play all of these one and two mana ramp spells.
Yeah, I was playing, like, the first time I won with it, I played, like, Search for Tomorrow, Nature's Lore, Three Visits, and Solemn, and Primeval Titan were my only ramp spells. I played, like, five ramp spells.
You didn't
and then
play Tribalder?
I probably played Secure Tribalder.
Sure, but you didn't play the bad ones.
But I wasn't playing Rampant Growth, wasn't playing Farseek, wasn't playing, like, some of these other ramp spells that you associate with.
Yeah.
Scapeshift decks.
Yeah, and as other players, like, Jonah Frazier has sort of played a bunch
of... Yeah, he's sort of
the Rug Scapeshift guy now.
Yeah.
And as he played it more, he kind of discovered that the ramp spells are good, but part of the reason they're good is that, like, not only do they ramp you in Scapeshift, but you also just, like, get to cast your Primeval Titan on turn 4. Or you get to cast this Drag Tusk on turn 4. And so, like, the deck is now just a mid-range deck that just happens to have a combo button. And I think it's really interesting that in the sort of 2-year time, we went from saying Scapeshift's not playable to, yeah, Scapeshift's super viable
archetype.
Possibly,
like, a tier 1.5, tier
right.
1 deck.
People thought that Jeremy might play it at the Highlander Top 8 last year. Like, you know, it was good enough that it was
I played a deck on people's radar. Not last year, but the year before in the top 8.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there you go. And then actually, I was going to mention one other card really quick, although we don't have it on the list, but it has occurred to me, which is Alluren as well.
Yeah,
which is another card that people said, no, it's too much, you can't build around it.
Too many deck building constraints.
Yeah, too many deck building constraints. And it turns out if you play that deck more than once, you can tune your deck to actually work. Yeah. Which is something that I think is part of the problem a lot of the times when people build Highlander decks, is that they build them, play them once, finally have some clunky draws, decide I'm just going to build something else, when in fact, with deck tuning, you can actually fix a lot of those problems.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I think, part of the sort of problem is people aren't willing to stick with it. They sort of pick it up, play it. It doesn't, like, feel like the well-greased machine they're used to, like their Jeskai midrange deck, or their, like...
Yeah, their mono-red aggro, or their...
Blue-green taking turns.
Yeah, blue-white control.
And they don't realize that, like, decks don't just come like this. People put a lot of work into getting the decks to that point.
Yeah, Patch Berdusco didn't win the first tournament he played Pod in. He played it 60 tournaments in a row.
Yeah.
And then started winning with it, right?
Exactly. Like... yeah. So, like, yeah, I played Alluren twice last year, and I 3-1'd the first time, and it, like, felt kind of weird. I cut a bunch of the weird cards, put in some more, like, value, like, just solid cards, and then won the tournament the next time I played it.
Yeah. So anyway, so it's really important to try cards out, because if you do try cards out, you might discover, you either might find the new hot archetype in Highlander, or at the very least, you know, you're going to discover, this card's not playable, or you're going to discover this card is playable, and it's going to help you build decks later on in the future, it's going to help you tune decks later on in the future.
One thing to note is that as you start tuning decks, you become much, much better at it, and you get to the point where decks are, like, you're able to tune decks to their, like, sort of optimal or close to their optimal point much quicker.
Yeah.
Like, I've been doing it for years now, and now, like, it usually only takes me 1 or 2 weeks to get a deck sort of close to a point where I feel like I can win a tournament with it if it's, like, a justifiable idea.
Yep. And one other thing I think that it's important to note is that you should... There's never really a time where I think you have to think, I'm done tuning this deck, I don't have to make any more changes to it, because in many ways, in Highlander especially, there's no sort of quote-unquote perfect version of a deck, right?
Exactly.
There's no perfect Jeskai deck, there's no perfect Craterhoof deck, because it's super dependent on what you're going to play against. And so once you sort of have gotten the tuning down and you sort of tuned it to a list that you like, well, now's where you can start doing the really interesting things of, now you're maybe just making... you're no longer making choices about what cards are bad, what cards do I not want to play. You've now just got this big list of cards that overperformed in the situations that they overperformed in, and you can start thinking, well, aggro's really popular right now, and probably the second most popular archetype is tempo. Well, I'm going to take these cards out of my deck that are good against control and bring these ones in that are good against aggro.
Yeah.
And you can start making those choices and building a better deck for the week.
Exactly.
Every time, which is also, I think, really cool, really important, and something that, is sort of an intrinsic value gained from tuning a deck that you don't get from building a new deck. Jeremy and I are both, like, certainly, I mean, I don't want to say guilty, this is not necessarily a bad thing, but we definitely try to beat whatever the metagame is, right? We look at the metagame and we say, what deck can we build that's good against this metagame? But that you absolutely don't have to do that.
No.
Right?
And most decks are sort of tweakable such that you can shift their focus from beating aggro to beating control to beating combo.
Yeah, absolutely.
To just being, like, more proactive, more reactive.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, you really do have the option to play one deck and play that deck in a way that it's going to be good against the field basically every week, if you're willing to put the time in and figure out the tuning. So that's the basic process of tuning a deck. Play your tournament, figure out which cards are good, figure out which cards are bad, maybe call those bad cards away slowly, figure out which cards are good contextually, work out why they're good, and then you can sort of start to tune your deck appropriately depending on what the metagame is.
Exactly.
So we'll switch now into talking about sort of more specific examples. And so it's interesting that we talked about Scapeshift earlier, because Scapeshift is the deck that I have been playing until this last tournament. I played it at every tournament before that, so I played it six times. Yeah, I played it six times.
Right?
Yeah, through 2 Mondays, 2 Thursdays, 2 Saturdays. So I played it 6 times, and we're gonna post with this podcast the final list, and I'm also gonna stick in that list a maybe board.
Sure.
And that maybe board's gonna be about 25 cards. It's basically gonna be every card that was ever in the deck.
And if anyone would ever, I don't know why this would happen, question Liam's dedication to Highlander, he drove back across the country, arrived on Thursday, didn't quite make that Thursday tournament.
I was late.
But since, has not missed a Highlander tournament.
I missed a Saturday. I played Standard instead.
All right, sure.
But
sure.
I had to acquire the hot Standard Showdown cards in order to play more Highlander. I also did play a Highlander deck in Standard.
That's true. You did play a Standard Highlander deck.
Yeah, so it's fine.
Liam's dedication to the cause, unquestionable.
Pretty high.
Like, the drive across Canada, for those of you who don't know, is like 10 days if you turbo.
It's like 6 days if you turbo. We drove 8 hours a day, and it was 10.
Sure, that's still quite...
Yeah,
quite
it was
drive.
A full work day every day. No, it's not short, that's for sure. So I don't know, I still have been playing a bunch. I like this format, obviously. It's interesting that when I was talking about the Scapeshift list, I was saying that, you know, people initially were trying to build this turbo Scapeshift deck that's just trying to ramp as quickly as possible, find Scapeshift and kill you, and that list was bad. Okay, maybe that list wasn't that bad and people hadn't spent enough time on it. Typically people have played Rug Scapeshift, and you do so because it's a mid-range deck. And Jeremy and I talked, I played a couple of different decks the first week and a half I was here, but Jeremy and I had been talking about, other decks I could play, and Jeremy mentioned that, and I mentioned that I kind of wanted to play Scapeshift, and Jeremy said he thought the version with black in it was better. And we talked about it a little bit about why that is, and it's a contextual thing, but basically this version is much more of a combo deck than a mid-range deck. You eschew a lot of the more mid-range cards in favor of trying to kill people as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
And so over the course of playing this deck, I made some choices that I actually sort of never thought you would make playing a Scapeshift deck. So for instance, my deck does not play Primeval Titan. Like, we cut that card. And you'd think, holy heck, that card's insane with Scapeshift. Surely it's got to be correct to play. Turns out it's not in this deck. And what I found, the process that I went through to decide that Primeval Titan wasn't good enough for the deck, was that most of the time, I'm playing so many ramp spells in this deck. I'm playing the Cultivates, the Kadamas Reaches. I'm playing...
Rampant Growth, Farseek. Yeah,
Sky Shroud Claim. That most of the time when I was hitting 6 mana, I was actually hitting 7 mana. Like, I very rarely ended up on 6 lands with no way to get a 7th.
Exactly.
Which meant that a lot of the times, Primeval Titan was ramping me from 7 to 9, but 9 is meaningless most of the time.
Yes.
8 can sometimes be important. Some decks can take 0 damage, but 7 is usually enough to kill people, and 8 is definitely enough to kill most people.
And sort of the other reason to issue, like, sort of the big finishers is that with the addition of black, this deck is actually much more reliably getting Scapeshift in its hand when it wants it. You get all the black tutors, you're playing, for instance, your points are spent on Demonic Tutor and Vampiric Tutor as opposed to Ancestral Recall, and you get additional tutors like Clutch of the Undercity, Bring to Light, Dark Petition.
Yeah.
So you're just much better at actually getting the payload card you need when you need it, as opposed to the Rug version just doesn't have enough tutors to reliably find Scapeshift.
Yeah, Rug is kind of on Mystical Tutor, finds it. Sometimes they play Mystical Teachings, but...
like, roundaboutly find it.
Yeah, but slowly find it. But yeah, in this deck, obviously, we're finding it much faster. And when I cut Primeval Titan, I actually cut Primeval Titan for another tutor. I wasn't playing Dark Petition, and I replaced Primeval Titan with Dark Petition.
Yeah.
Which was, like, certainly the correct decision. So there are some other interesting choices that I ended up making, though. For instance, even though the deck is not a mid-range deck, you still need to have a plan to win besides having Scapeshift, because there are cards like Blood Moon that are pretty popular in the format, and Back to Basics. And since you're a four-color deck, you really are kind of bending over backwards to try and fit as many basics into your deck as possible. And I'm playing 7 non-mountain basics and 8... 8 basics if you count the mountain, but you basically never want to fetch for that one.
It looks like you're playing 7 total, right?
Oh, sorry, yeah. So six non-mountain basics, seven. Yeah, it was higher, but then the cycling lands came out. Certainly a boon to this deck.
Yeah, if Wizards is going to continue printing, like, land-type dual lands, this deck just continues to get better, because the less actual basic mountains you have to play in this deck,
the better
it is.
Yes. But in order to be able to beat the Blood Moon and Back to Basics style effects, you need a plan. And you don't need a bunch. Like, that's the kind of thing that Primeval Titan was good with. But it actually isn't as good as killing people as some other things. So I went spicy for the first iteration of things that I tried. I think it's still in the deck. No, it's not. Damn it. All right, it got cut. It's not in the final list. But I was playing Metallurgic Summonings in my deck. From the first draft to the second last draft. And the theory was, if you can resolve a Metallurgic Summonings, all of a sudden, all your tutors, all your ramp spells, everything comes with a creature stapled to it. And so it doesn't actually matter if you're spinning your wheels doing nothing, because you're still generating threats that your opponent has to deal with. And eventually you can either find an answer to the permanent that's kind of locking you down, or you can just kill them with 4/4s and 5/5s. I mean, that's how I won a game against Blue Moon, was just, like, I resolved turn 4 Metallurgic Summonings and proceeded to cast a bunch of spells that didn't matter that we countered them.
And a quick note that cards like that are especially good in decks like Scapeshift that can power them out earlier with ramp spells.
Absolutely. So that card was good, but in the interests of tuning, you know, I was looking for another kind of good mid-range card that I could play, and in particular, I lost to Blue Moon. I lost to Blue Moon the tournament before, and I was thinking, yeah, Blue Moon's a really bad matchup. I probably can't play this Metallurgic Summonings because it actually requires two blue mana of my deck. I probably want to play a red card to sort of help me close out games, because I can cast it through Blood Moon, and in particular, the card I chose actually helps me beat Magus of the Moon, and that card is Chandra Flamecaller, which is the 6-mana Chandra. It has the uptick. It starts at 5 loyalty.
4.
4 loyalty, and it upticks to 5, and it makes the 3-1-1, or the 3-1 haste elemental, so it hits for 6, makes 2 of those. It can minus X to deal X damage to each creature and player.
Each creature.
Each creature. And it can 0 to make you discard your hand and then draw that many cards.
So it sort of does everything the deck wants to do. It's an expensive finisher that's very, very fast at closing out the game.
Yeah, it's usually 3 turns.
Decks will often deal damage to them. You often have, like, bolts.
Yeah.
So, like, it can often be less than that. It can help you cycle through your deck, especially if your hand isn't very good.
Yep.
And it helps Wrath, like, keep the board clear.
It can clean up a board as well.
Especially in conjunction with the ramp spells, this can come down on turn 4. It's not unreasonable for that to happen.
No.
And that's sort of when you want your Wrath to happen.
Yep.
So
that was, like, another interesting sort of tuning choice, was finding the right mid-range card. I'm going to make one more note about a kind of somewhat interesting tuning decision I made, and this one was partially aesthetic, and so it was very funny. Jonah and I were talking, because he was sort of lamenting the fact that actually the 4-color Scapeshift deck's mana is in some ways better than the 3-color Scapeshift deck's mana, because Jonah has to just jam 7 basic mountains in his deck. Because you want at least 11 mountains in your deck for Scapeshift. Arguably, you want 12, because you're going to draw a couple over the course of the game. You kind of don't want to lock yourself out of winning with Scapeshift just by, like, having unlucky draws or something of that variety. And in my deck, where I'm especially bad at winning the game without Scapeshift, I wanted to play 12 a lot of the time. I don't think I actually ultimately ended up finding room for a 12th. I'm still playing 11. But I that's actually, if I kept playing this deck, I think I would try and find room for a 12th mountain. But so, the other thing that Jonah and I were talking about, Jonah and I both really like the Unhinged Basic Lands. We really like that art style.
Yeah, you both have sets of...
Yeah, like we both have enough Unhinged Basic Lands that we can play them in decks like Scapeshift where there's only 2 or 3 basics of each type.
Yeah.
But there's a ramp spell called Into the North, which fetches for snow lands, which includes snow-covered basics. And in Jonah's deck, it's slightly better because it finds Dark Depths. I'm not playing Dark Depths. You'll see in the maybe board, though, that I used to be. When I was playing Primeval Titan, I did, but I decided I didn't like the card very much. It was really clunky a lot of the time, and I wanted all of my mana on most of my turns.
Yeah.
But, so, even after I cut the Dark Depths combo, I still was thinking, man, my draws where I have a ramp spell on 1 or 2 are just so much vastly better than the draws where I don't, that I think I have to play this into the North card. And it was so funny because Jonah and I, of course, are talking about, like, man, we have to go buy these snow-covered basics. You know, we don't really want to try and track these down. We have these nice basics we spent all this time and money finding, and now we just can't play them. Like, but playing into the North was, like, certainly the correct decision. Because the turns where you just have turn two ramp spell are just, or the games where you have turn two ramp spell are just so much better than the games where you don't.
Yeah.
It's not close. The difference is enormous. And so I did, you'll notice all my basics are snow covered. And I do have that into the North card in my deck. And I hate it. And I wish I didn't have to, but it's correct. And so I must. But yeah, so like those are just sort of like a couple of the interesting tuning decisions that came up. Oh, actually, I'm going to talk about one more. Sorry, the interesting tuning decisions that came up during the course of making the deck. The last one I'm going to talk about is Madcap Experiment, which I just noticed now. I played the first three tournaments of this deck without having Madcap Experiment in my deck. For those of you who don't know exactly how this combo works, if you cast Madcap Experiment and the only artifact in your deck is a Mirror Empyrean,
Platinum Empyrean.
Sorry, yeah. Which I think maybe didn't make it. Oh no, it's in the creature section. Yeah. Anyway, it's the only artifact in my deck. So you don't take any damage. Your life total can't change. So upon the resolution of the spell, sees that effect in play, and your life total doesn't change. And your life total can't change for the rest of the game as long as that thing stays alive. And this card is nuts against, this combo is nuts against mono red. It's really good against a lot of the aggro decks in Highlander. Some of them have more answers than others, but in particular, Mono Red really struggles to kill this card.
Yeah, and it still just forces them to have an answer, right?
Exactly. And what I found is that I lost a bunch of matches against Mono Red that I sort of felt like I was a turn too slow. I would get to 6 mana, or I would get to 7 mana, or 7 lands, but they wouldn't have taken any damage because their lands are mostly basics.
Yeah.
They don't play fetch lands. And so I would sort of feel like, oh, I have this tutor in hand, or I could have tutored on the turn previous. And I always end up either trying to find Wrath or trying to find Counterspell in order to sort of fend off this mono red deck, and I just end up dying. And so I talked to Jonah, who also is playing Madcap Experiment, who said, this card's nuts. It's a really low opportunity cost. The only card that you lose that you might play in a deck like this is Sensei's Divining Top. But actually, Jeremy and I both don't think that card is very good in a lot of decks. And it's interesting because this is a deck where top ought to be amazing. Right, you're shuffling with like 25 to 30 effects in your deck or something. You've got this pile of tutors and ramp spells and fetch lands.
You're playing all the fetches.
Yeah, exactly. But even then, it's just too much mana. And so it's a low opportunity cost to take out. You take it out and you put Platinum Empyrean in. And it was like super rewarding because the very next tournament I played against Mono Red twice. I cast, you know, Madcap Experiment on turn four, like twice. And I won both matches, right? Like,
yeah.
It was just a very obvious, like, yes, here's a tuning decision I've made that has directly impacted my win rate. But that only came about after playing a couple tournaments and discovering I'm a turn too slow to beat mono red. Because you might, if you just built this deck, you might think, yeah, we can race mono red. We'll kill them on turn 5 or 6. Like, we have
a couple counter spells right. to slow them down.
We have some interaction.
A couple removal spells.
Exactly. And in practice, what ends up happening, and what I discovered through playing the games, is that if you are playing your ramp spells, you can't also hold up counter spell or removal spell.
Yeah.
And if you just hold up counter spell and removal spell, they will work through those things too quickly. They can hold up instant speed stuff, force you to float your mana a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And your control game is just not powerful enough to match up with what a lot of the mono red decks are doing.
Yeah.
But if you just cast Madcap Experiment on turn 4 or 5...
They don't have a lot of ways to interact with that one.
Not a whole lot. And you can pretty regularly do that, and you have a bunch of tutors anyway to go find it, so it was a sort of very potent change to make. So yeah, anyway, so you'll find the final list, it's version 1.4, I guess, in the...
The notes for the show.
Yeah, and I will include... If the maybe board isn't there when you click on it, I swear it's coming... as we're looking at the list right now, the maybe board isn't there, but I will put it in. It should be like 25, 30 cards, basically things that I thought about playing in the deck that either got cut or didn't make it into the deck ultimately, but were in that sort of stack of cards that we've been talking about that maybe make it into the deck if you discover some card is actually not as good as you hoped it would be.
So
that's Scapeshift.
So move on. I sort of have been planning to play a green-white midrange deck for a while. It's actually one of my favorite decks to play. It's sometimes it's nice to just, like, play a deck that sort of pilots itself for the most part. You make most of your decisions in deck building, and that's sort of why I thought it would be a good deck to tune, because that's where you make the majority of your decisions. The play style of this deck is actually fairly straightforward. Most of the decisions are fairly obvious. There are a couple tutors and a couple tricky cards in the deck, but by and large, it's a green-white midrange deck. So there are a couple interesting choices we've made. Always Watching is sort of another card that could have gone on the card people think is bad list, or underplayed, underutilized card. Liam taking a hot podcast selfie.
It's for Twitter, man. That picture of me is horrendous.
I've been really wanting to try this card out. I think it's quite good. I think giving your creatures vigilance in mid-range matchups or against aggro decks is pretty nutty, especially since your creatures are often much bigger than your opponents or have relevant combat abilities. And also being able to attack and use abilities through vigilance, very relevant with cards like Knight of the Reliquary, sometimes Mother of Runes, Fauna Shaman, just allowing you to sort of, especially against combo and control, when all those cards can attack anyways, there are no blockers. Your mana dorks getting to attack, and making your mana dorks bigger, not irrelevant,
yeah,
sort of makes the inclusion of them more acceptable.
Well, and I think one of the strongest aspects of some of the mono-white decks, we've actually talked about how there are different flavors of mono-white, but some of the mono-white decks, like that Honor the Pure style effect is part of what makes them so effective, right? That card comes down and you sort of feel like, oh god, how am I gonna beat this, right?
It makes every threat following much more impactful.
Right, and it totally mucks up combat math if you're a creature deck trying to figure out racing. It totally messes with control decks trying to figure out, like, well, what attacks do they make? What effects do they try to leave up? Do they play around my flash creature? And the answer is just like, no, I just attack. You know, and we'll figure that part out when you play your spell.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and like, as I said, being able to like attack with the Mother of Runes while still keeping her up.
Yeah.
Her ability up, or attack with Fauna Shaman while still being able to, like, discard a card, get Archangel Abyssin, cast Archangel Abyssin before damage. It's like pretty backbreaking. Another card we're playing that doesn't see much play is Seed Time. A Jerry Liam classic, really.
The card I try and slip into your deck at all times when you play green?
Yeah. I've played it more than anyone else in Highlander, I would wager.
Right, so you played it twice?
Yeah. I've actually played it, I think, 5 or 6 times.
Oh, okay.
I've cast it probably 8 to 10 times.
Mm-hmm.
It feels sweet. Everyone always reads it. They're like, why is this a Magic card? But it's really good against blue decks. Very bad against others.
In fact, probably unplayable against others.
Thankfully, there's a lot of blue decks. So this deck is... Yeah, as I said, a straightforward deck, largely just trying to play a mana dork on turn one, play a 3-drop, maybe deploy another threat, and then cast Armageddon or Ravages. Has a lot of utility, sort of Hatebear-esque creatures in it. Very resilient with cards like Recruiter of the Guard, Renegade Rallier, Selfless Spirit, just like good at being annoying to other decks. Another card I really wanted to try out recently is Sigarda Heron's Grace.
You also opened a foil one.
Yeah.
Let's not forget the most important reason to play this card.
Yeah, trading foil one for 4 and non-foil. Anyone out there? So, the reason I like this card a lot is it's easier to cast than the other Sigarda, and it gives you hexproof, which is actually a big game against a lot of combo decks. I think the other Sigarda having hexproof is relevant, but a lot of removal spells don't actually kill a 5 toughness flyer that has greater than 3 converted mana cost. Or it gets greater than 4
now because of
Fatal
Push. But yeah, for sure. I mean, like, this thing's still only dying to, like, Swords, Path, Wrath,
Exactly.
You know, most of the things that are going to kill a Hexproof creature anyway.
Exactly. There aren't many single target removal spells that killed this version that didn't kill the last version.
Yeah.
And it gives you a way to sort of use your graveyard as a resource, which this deck doesn't utilize very much, and just go wide.
Yeah, there's like virtually no tax on the graveyard in this deck, right? So you can
exactly
pretty comfortably exile things. There's no delve spells. There's nothing that's looking for you to have things in your graveyard.
No, it's like just Knight of the Reliquary, I think.
Yeah.
For lands.
Yeah.
So we started with this deck. I'll add the maybe board to this deck as well. Liam and I built it the other day, and we sort of have a pile of cards that's still sitting on my dining room table that I will add to the maybe board, so...
There are cards sitting in front of us right now that got cut.
You're right.
There's, like, this Silverblade Paladin, this Wolfier Silverheart, this Forest that got cut because we had too many cards.
Yeah.
These cards, not in maybe board. No. Moments Peace or Veteran Explorer in this deck, I don't think. But...
Or Coruscant Grip. Those were, sadly, extras from once 12 posts.
Yes. Great tragedy.
Can't play that deck in Legacy anymore.
No.
Sadly. Yeah, so this will be the first iteration of this deck I try. I'll make sure to continue to post other ones on our tapped out page.
Well, and maybe what we'll do is that now that I'm back in Victoria, we will be posting these at a more regular clip. I'm not going to guarantee a specific day of the week, but I will tell you that they will be coming out more regularly.
Definitely. I think we're going to aim for one every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Hopefully.
Sometimes maybe more, sometimes maybe less.
Yeah,
we're busy. Especially in the summer. We also like to do other things, but...
Yes, that is true. But maybe what we'll do is we'll check in with Jeremy, too, on future episodes to just do a little brief check-in to see
exactly
what changes got made, why they got made, kind of in the same style of how I talked about the Scapeshift deck.
Yeah.
Because Jeremy's going to play this tournament, which is today on a Thursday.
Going to play it at least again on Monday.
Yeah.
And then, hopefully again on Thursday.
Right, so we'll see. Might get a whole three tournaments out of him.
I'm actually going to play this Saturday as well.
Okay, perfect.
So.
Yeah, so there'll be a bunch. But anyway, we'll check in. There will have been several tournaments by the time we record again, and Jeremy will be able to sort of comment reasonably extensively about what cards were good, what cards were bad, things that he put in, things that he took out, to give you all at home an idea of sort of what the tuning process looks
like. And yeah, just to go through the process we talked about earlier, like I'll talk about which cards overperformed, which cards underperformed, which cards I was constantly wanting to draw, which cards I was like, oh god, please don't draw this.
Yeah.
And quite often, I just want to talk about that a lot, quite often the cards that end up falling into that category are mana versus non-mana.
Yes, so, and it's important to know the distinction between it's late game, I don't want to draw a mana dork, and like, yeah, mana's just bad at this time of the game. Like, it's late game, I don't want to draw this business spell that's not actually good.
Yeah, exactly. So, that's something to keep in mind. You don't want to, like, go cutting all your mana dorks just because you drew one late game.
Yes, precisely. That would be sort of a questionable choice.
Yeah.
So, normally what we do at the end of each episode is we review what the heck you and I are playing. Obviously, we've spent this entire
episode
talking about what we're going to play and what we're going to play.
Well, so you haven't talked about this pod deck too much.
Yeah, so I was going to say, I'll talk about this. But why don't you talk about a deck that you would like to build, or perhaps a deck that you have played in the last couple of weeks, just to give people another spicy meatball. Though you've actually played, you've been pretty vanilla in the last couple of weeks, right? You played Mono Red, Jeskai, you could talk about Esper Midrange, I guess. But
yeah, I've been pretty tame recently.
Yeah, you can talk about anything you want, though. It's not a problem.
Anything I want.
Yeah. Do you want me to go first, or do you
want
to go
first? Yeah, talk first, and then I'll think about what I want.
So this week, and this is the new project, is this Abzan Kiki Pod deck. And when I say Abzan Kiki Pod, there are red sources in the deck right now. There won't be tonight. I'm going to cut them all. I don't want to play any more red sources. So basically, I was just talking with someone about playing Abzan Pod, and one of the things that that deck typically does is that it has the Malira, or now maybe Vizier of...
Remedies.
Plus Sacrifice Outlet, plus Persist Creature combo. And so I kind of wanted to push the envelope a little bit, try not playing these cards, for a couple of reasons. One, it forces you to play a bunch of, like, not very good cards in your deck, right? You end up playing this, like, Viscera, this Malira, like, a couple of just, like, vanilla bears a lot of the time. And then Kitchen Finks and Murderous Red Cap, yeah, those cards are good. You should probably be playing them. But the other ones, they're actually kind of bad. And in the pod deck, especially when you're not using Pattern or Rebirth or Protean Hulk in order to find things, you actually probably want, like, multiple Sacketlets. You probably want to play Carrion Feeder. You probably want to play Veralds in your deck as well. And as you start talking about having more and more Sacketlets in your deck, like, a lot of these cards are just not especially good. They're just not... They don't have an Enter the Battlefield effect. They're just there to work with the combo. So I cut that combo from my deck. I didn't want to play it. There's another story as to why I cut that combo from my deck. But
perhaps
it
is because you do not own a Murderous Redcap.
That is too. That is it too. I texted Jeremy saying, hey, you have a Murderous Redcap I could borrow? And he went, nope, sorry, at the shop already. And I said, that's fine, I'll just cut it. and so I cut it. And so what I'm playing instead, and this is actually what I wanted to play in the Abzan pod deck to begin with, is there's a new pod chain with Felidar Guardian. I know, this card's great. Banned in Standard, pretty good at Highlander, where if you have a 3-drop creature, 3 mana and 6 life, you can win the game. Which is, it's 1 mana and 2 life faster than most of the other combos people are playing, and it's way faster than anything you can play without blue mana in your deck. You need to play blue mana otherwise in order to do some, like, either some Phyrexian Metamorphs shenanigans along with a Deceiver Exarch and a Restoration Angel.
And a lot of the other combos require either multiple creatures or you to have a specific 3-drop in play. This is any 3-drop.
Yeah.
And
you're good to go. So yeah. What you do is you can pod 3-drop into Felidar Guardian. Felidar Guardian flickers pod. Then you sack Felidar Guardian, turn it into Karmic Guide, get Felidar Guardian back, flicker pod. Then you sack Felidar Guardian again, get Kiki-Jiki, copy Karmic Guide, get Felidar Guardian back, and Felidar Guardian and Kiki-Jiki go infinite. So it's 3 life, 6 mana, and on Monday, when I played this deck for the first time, on turn 4, I went, or maybe it was turn 5, but I was able to go sort of like mana dork into like mana dork into play Birthing Pod, activate Birthing Pod, find Sylvan Ranger, play land, play another mana dork. No, it was turn 4. And then on turn 4, no, it was turn 5. I keep mixing it up. I'd seen my opponent's hand, because on turn 4 I had potted my Sylvan Ranger into a Sin Collector. In order to check for Counterspell, because they were a Counterspell deck, and had a bunch of removal as well. And their only form of interaction was a Venser Shaper Savant. And their second blue source was a fetch land. And I didn't even Mind Sensor in hand. And so I was able to...
Strong.
Yeah, so I was able to start comboing, respond to his fetch land, flash in Aven Mind Sensor, get his fetch land, he didn't find a blue source, and then with the remaining 2 mana I had left, sort of just combo kill my opponent.
Yeah.
Which is pretty sweet. So yeah, so this deck's cool. Like, it's playing a pod chain that people haven't played before. I think this pod chain's really good. I'm gonna play it a bunch. I think it's gonna be fun. But yeah, that's the sweet deck I'm playing. I'm playing Abzan Kiki Pod, soon to have no red sources, and as a result, no ways to cast Kiki Jiki. Turns out, not a problem. We can cord for it. You can find it pretty easily with Survival of the Fittest. It'll be fine. I'm not worried.
You can discard it to Survival of the Fittest.
That's
even
the
more
plan.
Important.
That's the plan. All right, Jer, hit us up. What are you going to play?
I'll just talk about... So I'm obviously going to be playing this green-white deck.
Yeah.
But I'll just talk about the deck I played last Monday, which was Esper Midrange. I haven't played it in a while. There's been a bunch of Jeskai decks running around, so...
Naturally, I'll
play the deck that I think just has like a great matchup against Jeskai and relatively good matchups across the board.
Right.
So I'll talk a bit about my match against Nathan Hogman. We had a pretty sweet match. I ended up winning in 2, but both games were pretty close. So in game 1, he ends up... He may have missed lethal, but he ends up getting the Vizier of Remedies stack out like Kitchen Finks combo into play.
This combo's dirt!
And says gain 8 million life. I'm like, yeah, sure, that's fine.
Right.
I had a pretty good board. I had like Burmaz, Monastery Mentor, Tombstalker, Gideon of Trials with an emblem on like maybe 8 counters. So I was like relatively ahead. I had some cards in hand. He was hellbent. So I'm like, I'm not going to concede. I can beat infinite life.
Right.
Or 8 million life. So we play a few more turns. I end up drawing some removal spells to kill most of his relevant things. I got a GTA in play for a couple turns before he was able to Reclamation Sage it. And then I drew Ashiok, and I'm like, sweet, this will be the this will be the one, because I had Force of Will. So I'm like, oh, it doesn't matter. I will just protect this Ashiok. So I tick up, and he immediately abrupt decays, and I'm like, hmm.
That one's good. Yeah, yeah.
And then two turns later, I drew Jace, and
right.
was able to ultimate the Jace.
Sick.
So that game was pretty sweet.
Yeah. And so what exactly is this Esper midrange deck, like, doing? Why is it so good against Jeskai?
So the reason it's good against Jeskai is because essentially you eschew red for black.
Right.
And black gives you access to the Delve creatures, which are incredibly strong, especially in the mirror match, because it allows you to play much bigger creatures than them earlier. And it gives you black removal spells, which enable you to target permanents more relevantly, so it makes your broad matchups better, but it also lets you target the problematic things in the mirror match, which are often planeswalkers. If planeswalker resolves in the mirror match, they have Into the Royal as like a temporary answer, Cryptic Command as a temporary answer, and Council's Judgment. Whereas you have Council's Judgment,
Vindicate,
Utter End,
Anguish Undermaking.
So like, it just you have better answers, you have better threats at some points. Like, you don't quite have the dragons, but Tombstalker, Avacyn, Baneslayer do a
pretty good impression.
Pretty reasonable impression. Dragonlord Ojutai as well sometimes sneaks in.
I like that one.
And you still just get to, by and large, play the same meat of the deck.
Right.
Right.
Similar plan, just like the removal suite is different and as a result better in the mirror.
And you also get hand attack, which makes your game against combo a lot better.
Right. You don't have this Arc Trail sitting in your hand against.
Exactly. Like, what would you rather have in your deck against combo? Duress Inquisition Thoughtseize or Chain Lightning Lightning Bolt Arc Trail?
Right. Yeah.
It's like not close. Right. Yeah. So.
Cool. That's yes. Midrange sounds sweet.
Yeah. Blue midrange deck. Kind of boring, but does some.
That's fine.
Different things. I don't know why. I'm the only one who plays the Esper version, but.
It's probably just like.
Graham Nathan's played it maybe once or twice.
Yeah.
But by and large, I don't think anybody else has really played it.
Yeah. And as usual, we'll sort of put the all call out, but if any of our listeners are interested in having us look at your decks, talk about your decks, please ship us your lists.
Have some sweet ideas
or even
things you want us to talk about.
Right. And even if you don't have a list, if you just have an idea for a deck that you like want to have fleshed out a little bit more, ship us your idea. The two best places to do that, the number one best place to do it is Twitter. I promise you I will always reply to Twitter if you tweet at us. And our Twitter is @CanLander. It'll be in the description. You can find it. But it's @CanLander. I will always respond to that 100% of the time. So if you really want to get a hold of us, tweet at us @CanLander. Follow us. It's all very good. If you want to as well, you can email us.
I'm going to get better at checking the email again.
Yeah.
I got a new phone and forgot that the... Forgot to set up a Canadian Highlander email. I used to like get them both.
Yeah,
but I will set it up such that I get both again. So I will do better at checking that.
And that email will be in the description as well. I believe it's CanadianHighlanderMTG@gmail.com.
It is. You're right. Yeah.
CanadianHighlanderMTG@gmail.com. Yep. Yeah, so
no underscores or anything.
No, just all one word. So yeah, ship us emails, tweet at us. Sort of let us know what you're thinking.
I guess we should should we mention the new council election?
Oh yeah, sure.
Might as well shout out to Liam. Come back immediately, get elected back onto the council.
Sure.
So the new council as of Monday, the 8th, is myself, Ben, and Ben Wheeler are the only incumbents.
Yeah,
and then Liam, Adam Thorne, and Garrett Kulos are the new people on the block.
Yep.
Congrats to all of them. They all deserved it.
It was a super hotly contested election. We'll maybe talk about this more next time. But
yeah.
But
it just occurred to me that was something that happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, just before we go, follow us on Twitter @CanHighlander. Email us CanadianHighlanderMTG@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. And we're glad to be back.
Yeah. Yeah. See ya.
See ya.